It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our summer music series set list, where we interview musical performers, hear them play in our own studios. Today we'll feature the Milwaukee band Field Report. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Governor Walker is in, John Doe is done. We'll get the latest on those stories and more now with Jesse Apoyan, politics reporter for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, the week started with big news that we all kind of knew was coming. Governor Walker kicked off his presidential campaign. Things have changed, though, since he made that announcement in terms of national scrutiny. How so?
Yeah, I mean, huge shocker, right? We knew from the minute he won his re-election for governor last fall that he was going to be doing this, but it's finally official. And as a result of that, now that we're really not waiting on any more candidates to get in the race, Walker's been the subject of high-level scrutiny for a while to begin with. He went through the recall election, but he's facing more attention and a brighter spotlight than he's had before just because he's got a national press following him, and he's got 14-15 other candidates trying to take him down and watching everything he's doing.
Are there issues that people are seeing creating curveballs already for the governor?
It's been an interesting week because of social issues for Walker. During his re-election campaign in 2014, he really stayed away from things like gay marriage or abortion and just kind of said, well, you know, those aren't things that people are talking to me about. Those aren't things where my opinion matters. And there's been a shift in that, and that he's not so much shying away from answering those questions this time around. But on some of those, there's a little bit of hesitancy to let himself be nailed down on what exactly he does think.
And there's been, from his critics, definitely a lot of effort to say, here's what he was saying then, here's how he's talking differently now.
Definitely. I think the most stark example of that's been abortion. In 2014, he had that ad in October when a lot of the pro-choice groups were hitting him on his record. He put out an ad that said, you know, it's an agonizing decision to end a pregnancy. The bills that we've passed leave the decision to a woman and her doctor. And since then, as he's been on the national scene as a conservative presidential candidate, a lot of pro-life groups had said, hey, what do you mean by that? And he's had to backtrack on a little bit and say, no, I didn't really mean it should be between a woman and her doctor. And in fact, I am going to sign this 20-week abortion ban, and I want the legislature to pass it so it'll get on my desk.
Now, some good news yesterday from the perspective of Walker's campaign. The state Supreme Court ended the John Doe probe, already halted, of his recall election campaign and outside conservative groups. We got the details in that ruling yesterday with our own Sean Johnson. But I wanted to ask you, Jesse, about the reaction since then. First, what have we been hearing from Democrats and campaign finance reform advocates since yesterday's ruling?
I think the two big things we're hearing from Democrats and campaign finance reform advocates is, one, Democrats are saying, well, now that this probe is halted and now that these documents are all going to be deleted, we're never going to find out for sure what exactly was going on between the governor's campaign and between those independent groups. The other thing we're hearing is this completely changes the campaign finance landscape. People on both sides of the aisle are saying it's time to reform the laws a little bit, make some changes. But, this ruling says those groups can work closely with candidates, and there's not a whole lot that they can't do at this point.
And you also reported on what Republicans and the governor's supporters have had to say.
Right. I mean, this is vindication for them. They've said, you know, for the longest time, this is a partisan witch hunt. There's nothing to this. And this ruling, they can say, you know, this has been disproven over and over and over again. It's not an issue.
Talking to Jesse Apoyan from the Capital Times in our Wisconsin News Roundup. Some national news got a Wisconsin angle this week. A group released a video with a Planned Parenthood official apparently talking about the uses of fetal tissue from abortion procedures and research. A lot of response nationally. Pro-life groups, congressional Republicans saying this is showing illegal and unethical behavior. Planned Parenthood and supporters say this video is misleading. The use of these tissues done within the law without profit for the group. Here in Wisconsin, there's been a response, Jesse. What are we seeing?
There has. Two Republican lawmakers now, a representative and a senator, have asked for an investigation. Representative Jesse Kramer, who actually authored that 20-week abortion ban, sent a letter to DHS and the governor, to legislature, asking for an investigation into Planned Parenthood. However, Planned Parenthood's response is, well, first of all, the video is misleading, but also the Planned Parenthood clinics in Wisconsin don't actually participate in that fetal tissue donation.
Is there any kind of timeline for when they're calling for this investigation, or is this just putting the idea out there right now?
Pretty much so far, just putting the idea out there. I reached out to the governor's office and DHS yesterday. I haven't heard anything back in terms of whether or not this is something they'll actually pursue.
And one more piece of news, focused in the Milwaukee area, but of statewide interest, given how it'll be paid for. The Milwaukee Bucks Arena advanced a little bit. The Senate passed it this week, a funding plan.
Yes, it did. With much more bipartisan support, I think, than people initially expected. Got a couple legislators to come around on that, and it sounds like the Assembly is looking it over, and all signs point to them passing it whenever they do take it up, and that'll probably be sometime within the next week or two.
And we've been saying this is really the last holdout from the whole budget process. This is the one thing that got pulled out and didn't get put back in. This would finally put the budget to bed.
Exactly. And it's also really the one issue that Governor Walker has been pushing the entire time. A lot of those things that he proposed in the budget, he was really kind of quick to say, yeah, you know, you don't have to pass it that way exactly. But this Bucks proposal has been the one where he's been stepping out in front of it and saying, we really need to make this happen.
And do you think some Republicans have been opposed to this? But this isn't, they're going to make nice after this probably, even though the rhetoric's gotten a little heated on both sides.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is one of those very rare issues in Wisconsin that's more regional than bipartisan, or more sort of personally philosophical than an actual party line position.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jesse Apoyan, politics reporter for the Capital Times, helping us break down the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our new summer music series called Setlist. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. You can hear them every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. Today's featured band, Field Report, hails from Milwaukee and has toured in support of artists like Jeff Tweedy, Amy Mann, and Counting Crows. The band's songwriter and frontman, Chris Porterfield, recently sat down with us in the WPR studio to play some songs, tell us why he got back into playing music, and explain the delicate balance of touring and regular home life. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio.
Rob, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, new album, Marigolden. So, I'm hearing Marigold and Golden. What are you conjuring up with that title?
You just nailed it, man. it's a word that just kind of came to us while we were making it, and it became kind of the umbrella that a lot of the songs could live comfortably under. But, you know, marigolds up here in Wisconsin, sort of a hardy plant, have sort of a rich, sort of autumnal color. They kind of stink. They're not so floral. They're a little bit more pungent. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of the frail flowers. They're sort of the hardy ones. But even at the end of the season, you know, winter's still so cold that they die, and you got to dig them up. And that's kind of the thing, is you got to dig them up and decide if you want to do it again. And then if you do, you got to replant them. And so it's kind of a play on being golden or being anointed or blessed somehow. You know, it's sort of an ugly, earthy, loamy take on the opposite of golden. And I don't know that I can be raised to go what you need.
You're away from home a lot, and this comes up in your lyrics. Do you have an ambivalence? I mean, obviously you love doing the music, but it takes you away.
It does take you away, and it's a weird thing. It's sort of this other life, and it took me a while to figure out that balance. I've been touring and doing music full-time for maybe 3 or 4 years now, and I didn't figure out that balance at first.
How do you make that balance?
Well, there's no cheap way to figure it out. You just kind of have to slog through it, I think. Just trying to be present in every situation, I think, is a good life lesson for all of us, no matter what our vocation is.
And I'm hearing things like, in effect, I'm not sure home is going to be like it was when I left. I'm not sure if people are going to see me the same way. I'm going to see home the same way. It's like a mythic theme almost.
It really is. And, yeah, you know, the way to learn about the world is to go out into it, and then it follows you back wherever you go, and it sort of changes your whole paradigm. You know, you always pine for the people that you love and care about, and then when you get there, you know, life isn't always like a movie where everything's tied up in a nice closing sequence. You know, you got to keep living after the closing sequence, too. Leave the lights on, 'cause it
I am kind of a homebody. I never could imagine living, but you know, touring, living life on the road. Could you imagine not doing that?
Boy, it's become a part of my life, a deep part of it. No, I hope I don't ever have to stop doing it. I like to continue doing it smarter and easier, but the act of getting out and being in front of people who have chosen to join you on that given evening, it's a pretty heady honor, and I love doing it.
And the body remembers what the mind forgets. It archives every heartbreak, every cigarette. These reset bones, they might not hold, but they might yet.
Now, one thing that's changed in some of the shows you've been doing, you've played before some pretty big names, Counting Crows, Amy Mann, Emmylou Harris. Is there something different about, playing a local show in Wisconsin versus, being up in front of a big name like that?
You know, you learn something from every show. And yeah, it's been a thrill being able to share stages with some people whose work I've admired for my whole life. We just did a bunch of European dates with Jeff Tweedy from Wilco in January. And you learn from these people because they've learned it on their own and from other people too, you know? You do something long enough and you just figure out how to get better at it.
And the car shall be blue like the one in the photo of your father and you. Blue like the label on the beer you always choose. Blue like me and you, Michelle.
Getting back to your latest album, another theme that comes out, emerges in songs, is your relationship with alcohol and alcohol and your music. And I use the word emerge. Did it just kind of come up, or did you go in consciously thinking, I'm going to write about alcohol on this album?
It wasn't a conscious thing, really. But it turns out that I'd been writing about it all along. Everybody's got a different relationship with alcohol, and especially in the state of Wisconsin, in particular, we have sort of a culturally unique, I've discovered as I've traveled, relationship with alcohol. And that culture can create problems for some of the people that live in Wisconsin. And it turns out I was one of those people. I'll never forget, I was at a show somewhere in New Mexico, maybe, I think it was. And somebody after the show came up and asked me, like, so is it you or somebody close to you that's the addict that you're talking about? And I was gobsmacked. I didn't know what to do with that, you know. Several drinks deep, drink in hand, talking to a stranger, assessing my art and my life through the lens of my art in ways that I had never considered. And so it had presented more problems than solutions for me, but it all kind of came to a head right about the time that this series of songs was being completed and getting ready to go into the studio. So yeah, some of the songs were pre-drinking, some of the songs were post-drinking.
Wow.
But it's been a really good thing in my life and in my work. I'm pleased that I've been public about it because I've had a chance to interact with other people who've appreciated sharing my experiences and their experiences with me and just providing a little solidarity in what can be a pretty wet place to live.
Well, Wisconsin, yeah, and playing music, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
most shows are at bars or places that serve alcohol. It's just natural for a lot of the musicians and audience to drink before, during, and after the set. Is it hard? Is it a temptation, like, to have that present all the time?
It took me a while to figure out how to perform and write and be around all of it, but I figured out how to do it now pretty well. It's not an easy shift, but if you're out there and you're thinking that maybe this is kind of sounding like you, maybe have a think about it and talk to somebody, and, you know, there's resources out there, and you are far from alone.
I've been 2 weeks dry in a bar every night. I've been passing coffee, quinine, and lime.
Yeah, the fog's been lifting and I'm doing all right. But I still can't look nobody in the eye.
Well, let's go back to Eau Claire. Now, you started there. You moved to Milwaukee more recently. Do you still have strong ties to this big music scene in Eau Claire?
Yeah. I still keep in touch with a lot of people that have been there or are there now. We get back a few times a year, and I'm really excited about the festival that's happening there this summer.
Yeah, the Eau Claire's festival, you're playing there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you part of the planning stages at all? I know they're bringing a lot of people in to talk about how this gets rolling.
Oh, no, I'm not.
I'm
not hiring food trucks or you know, setting up outhouses or anything like that. But
That was part of the band's rider for that. You only play if you get to set up the porta-johns.
Well, that's the nice thing about this is, like, a lot of times band puts on festival, you know, there's that kind of thing happening, and everybody, it's that kind of team effort, but this one seems to be a slightly different team effort. They're bringing in some people that can really execute on a level that is sort of a greater scope than just sort of a backyard operation. And it's allowing Justin Vernon and some of the other folks who are planning this to really just generate ideas and have some help in executing those. And so since it is sort of artist driven, there's going to be a lot of really cool, maybe unorthodox things happening. Like I said, I'm not in the planning stages, but I'm close enough to the circle to hear things. And it's going to be really cool to be able to share that part of the state with people from really all over the world. I mean, I've been touring this year for pretty much since January, just about nonstop. And I swear, just about every night in any given city, somebody will come up to me at the end of the show and say, "Man, can't wait for Eau Claire."
Now the next thing I know, I'm on your back with a suitcase full of long things back. We're out looking for your family, the devil and back. Every bar we chose to pass on.
What was it like moving from being an Eau Claire-based music guy to a Milwaukee-based musician?
It was different. The Eau Claire community is a little smaller, and it was really tight-knit. But by the time that I left Eau Claire, a lot of the people that I had come up with had also kind of spread out across the country. And so there weren't as many personal ties holding me there. And I went to school at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and met a woman from Milwaukee at school there. And she graduated and moved back home. I followed her to Milwaukee and got married. And I was finished with music at that point. Like, I was going to be a grown-up. And I was for a while. I got a job at Marquette University and worked in student affairs for 6 years and just kind of plugged into Milwaukee and marriage and adulthood and white picket fence and small dog and mortgage and all that. And I think I was pining for some of the vibe and the fellowship and the energy of Eau Claire and missing that and having that void in my life when I actually started writing on my own in Milwaukee. And now I'm plugged into Milwaukee, and I love it dearly, and it is my home. A wonderful community of people making and doing fantastic things, and I'm very proud of Milwaukee.
What's next? What are some of your future plans? Another album? Another project?
Yeah, I'm beginning to write for the next record. We'll finish touring out on Marigold in this summer, and then I've got some solo touring in the fall. And then we'll see where we're at and see if it's time to make a record.
All right, maybe spend some time at home that month.
Maybe some time at home.
Chris, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
My pleasure, thanks.
Leave the lights on, cause it might be nighttime when I get there, but I'm on my way home. Leave the lights on, cause it might be nighttime when I get there, but I'm on my way home. I'm on my way. On my way.
That was Milwaukee band Field Report. They're playing this weekend at the Eau Claire's Music Festival and August 1st at the Somerset Amphitheater. You can find a complete list of the band's tour dates at fieldreportmusic.com. Our Setlist Summer Music Series airs on Central Time each Friday at 4:15 through early September. For more about Field Report and other featured artists, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist. A lot of great music to be found there. Next Friday on Setlist, we'll feature the Madison psychedelic rock band Dolores. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. President Obama became the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. He made that visit yesterday in El Reno, Oklahoma, after spending much of the past week pushing for prison and criminal justice reform. On Monday, he commuted the sentences of 46 federal prisoners with nonviolent drug convictions. Tuesday, he spoke to the NAACP, calling for the reduction or elimination of mandatory minimum sentences. With roughly 2.2 million incarcerated people, the U.S. leads the world in both number of prisoners and percentage of the population in prison or in jail. President Obama made both a moral and economic argument for bringing that number down. This is a message he released this week.
Over the last few years, a lot of people have become aware of the inequities in the criminal justice system. The fact that we spend over $80 billion a year in incarcerating people, oftentimes who've only been engaged in nonviolent drug offenses. Right now, with our overall crime rate and incarceration rate both falling, we're at a moment when some good people in both parties, Republicans and Democrats, and folks all across the country are coming together around ideas to make the system work smarter, make it work better. And I'm determined to do my part wherever I can.
That's prison reform on the national scene, and it's a topic that hits close to home for many here in Wisconsin. The state incarcerates black men at the highest rate in the country. In Milwaukee, half of all black men in their 30s and 40s have spent time in jail or prison. Looking next door, Wisconsin and Minnesota have similar population sizes, demographics, and crime rates, but Wisconsin has more than double the prison population of Minnesota. Here with us now to talk about prison reform efforts in Wisconsin, we have David Liners, State Director of Wisdom, a grassroots organization of religious congregations. David, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Also, Anthony Daly joins us. He was previously incarcerated. Now he works with Wisdom's EXPO program that stands for Ex-Prisoners Organizing. Anthony, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Well, I wanted to ask both of you. Anthony, you first. What did you make of what the president's been saying on prison reform this week?
What I made of it is that he's paying close attention to the over-incarceration of a lot of men and women in the country, and there's time for a change.
And David, your thoughts from the president's efforts this week?
It was just really refreshing to hear him talk about it. It's been such an under-talked about issue, the problem of mass incarceration and the problem of racial disparities in incarceration. Nobody seems to want to touch it, and it's just exciting to see the president kind of wading straight into it and kind of speaking straight up about it.
And we have the president calling for reduction or elimination of mandatory minimum sentences, also reconsidering solitary confinement, increased worker training programs in prison and after. How does that compare to what, David, you've been calling for here in Wisconsin?
Some of it's very similar. We've been calling for a further expansion of treatment alternatives and diversions, programs that keep people with mental health or substance abuse problems out of prison by getting them into treatment programs so they can actually get better instead of just getting punished. We're also certainly calling for a reduction in the use of solitary confinement. That's just that's a horrendous practice that we have going on. And in Wisconsin, too, we need to do better than just kind of the low-hanging fruit, in a sense, of the first-time drug offender kind of thing. We need to deal with stopping having so many people having their supervision revoked, just kind of creating this revolving door for minor offenses. We need to deal, actually, with the length of sentences. The people with more serious crimes are just being kept in prison for just, you know, ridiculously long periods of time, much longer than is merited.
And some of what you just said, some of what the president said, has to do with the transition, life after prison. Anthony, you've made that transition. What works for people? Is it work training? Is it making it easier to get through that parole period without getting back into prison?
It hasn't been. It's been a tough role. Mm-hmm. After coming home. So you have to apply yourself, and you really have to do a lot of selling, you know, of yourself to the companies. And, you know, if not given a chance, it could hurt a person.
Well, I want to talk about some of what Wisdom is doing in Wisconsin. I want to start with the EXPO program, EXPO, that's Ex-Prisoners Organizing. You've both worked with this. This is new. This is something, the first graduating class I saw on the Facebook page just came out. You guys said it was in June last month. What kind of things did you do in preparing to be part of this EXPO program, Anthony?
Well, the things that I've done in preparation, I just was going into it, was what do I really want to take from this. And when I got there, I was going in there thinking it was going to be something totally different, and it was something that it really shook my cage. So
it shook his cage. David, why is it important to get ex-inmates, ex-prisoners involved in this kind of program?
I think the best thing that we heard that whole week was we had a fellow named Dorsey Nunn who came from California to speak to our group, who himself is formerly incarcerated. And he started off and said, "I just want to let you know you have a right not to remain silent." And I think that's kind of prison teaches people to be submissive, teaches people to kind of negate their value. And part of our training is about saying, no, we need to reclaim that. You need to be part of the solution. That it doesn't matter that you might have made a mistake at some point in your life. Now it's time to actually reclaim your power. And that's not a message that I think most of the formerly incarcerated folks are used to hearing.
We're talking about prison reform in the nation and in Wisconsin. President Obama has been talking about this issue pretty much the whole week, making the case that some things need to change. With us are David Liners and Anthony Daly, both involved in the state organization Wisdom, a grassroots organization of religious congregations that's been working on prison reform issues. Well, let's get into some of the policy, David. Sentencing. The amount of time people are sent to prison, a lot of people might hear, well, people have committed crimes. We want them to be punished, pay their debt to society. So why do we need shorter sentences?
Part of what we need to reconsider is, why are we sending people to prison in the first place? What are we trying to accomplish? If we're really trying to rehabilitate people, if we're trying to help people so that they'll do better, there's actually some evidence about how much time you need to do that. Sending people for 60, 80 years to prison, and a lot of times for crimes like accessory to armed robbery, not necessarily people who've done something heinous, it doesn't really serve any purpose, and it gets to be very costly. I mean, the fastest growing demographic in our prison are elderly people. So it doesn't make any sense to be sending people for just longer and longer periods of time. We need to reconsider why we're sending people, what do we want to accomplish, how much risk is acceptable. There's never zero risk of anything. So, yeah, we need to just take a good look at all of that. It's been kind of actually Grover Norquist was in town a couple months ago, and he was decrying the fact that we change sentencing laws according to the headlines in the newspaper on a given day.
Conservative activist Grover Norquist. So there's some across the spectrum support for this from different political parties. Well, that's part one, how long people spend in prison. Part two, maybe conditions in prison, solitary confinement, and other prison conditions. What kind of things, Anthony, do you see needing to change as far as what life in prison is like?
Well, respect of the guys and you know, the time that they're placed in solitary confinement, I think it should be eliminated altogether, because it doesn't do anything but turns a guy's mind, you know, crazy. You know, he goes through a thing, and you know, he doesn't, you know, that's a place where you're really alone, a time where you're really it's rough. You know, and
And we hear sometimes in response to this from people in the who work in the prison system, I should say, and guards that, no, it's not great, but sometimes there's a safety concern. The only way to protect the safety of staff and other inmates is solitary confinement. David, is there some room for limited use of it, even maybe not as much as we use it now?
There are places that will say up to 15 days might be acceptable. The United Nations has said anything more than 15 days consecutively of solitary confinement is torture. For a very short period of time, for the matter of safety, if there's a need to make other kinds of arrangements, there might be. But there's no good reason to keep someone in solitary confinement for 6 months, a year, 6 years, 10 years, as we've done. There's no good reason, and it just, as Anthony said, it just, it's amazing anybody comes out of it sane.
We're talking to David Liners and Anthony Daly with the group Wisdom about prison reform in Wisconsin. Yesterday, President Obama became the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. Earlier in the week, he commuted the sentences of 46 nonviolent federal prisoners. We'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you support what the president's doing to change things, what our guests are doing here in Wisconsin? Why not? What do you think about the incarceration rate in Wisconsin, racial disparity, the use of solitary confinement? If you've been to prison yourself or someone close to you, what was that reentry into life outside of prison like? What would have helped make that easier, give a better chance of keeping from going back into prison when all is said and done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about prison reform in Wisconsin with David Liners and Anthony Daly of the group Wisdom. That's a grassroots organization of religious congregations working on prison reform issues. Yesterday, President Obama became the first sitting president to visit a federal prison after a week dedicated to promoting this kind of prison and criminal justice reform. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support what the president's doing? What do you think about incarceration here in Wisconsin? Are we locking too many people up? What do you think about racial disparities? What can we do to fix these things if you think something needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, I know you've been working on the ban the box campaign. This has to do with getting jobs after leaving prison. And Anthony, you were talking to state legislators and some local officials yesterday. What is Ban the Box about?
Ban the Box is about getting a box removed off the application where question that they ask, have you ever been convicted of a felon? And we want to get it on a national level. We have it locally and in Milwaukee, and it's in a few, I think 17 other. Right.
Madison also has a pretty good ban the box.
Yep.
So what's the purpose of that, David?
It's so that a person actually gets a chance to present themselves. I mean, everybody has the real sense that if the front page of the job application, first thing staring at you is this box that says, have you ever committed a felony? And the person checked yes, that it's very little chance you're ever going to get a call back. That if it's germane to the job, they can always ask later, but at least we want people to have a chance to present themselves, to tell their own story and not just be categorized forever and completely by that box.
So, Anthony, it's a way to make it at least one hurdle to overcome in trying to get a job after prison.
Absolutely. It's a way to get you in the door and present yourself and your application and let the person see who you are today, not the person that you used to be. So.
All right, we'll get to our callers now. We've got Josh on the line in Rice Lake. Josh, hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Josh?
When I was 16, I'm 33 now. When I was 16 years old, I was sentenced to prison, an adult prison. I was sentenced to Prairie du Chien. I went through Dodge Correctional and all that stuff. And the job thing was difficult, and still is, and I'm 33 years old. I ran into other younger people that were thrown into prison under the age of 18. Just wondering what they if they had any comments about that or.
And Josh, before I let you go and get an answer from our guests, I mean, do you feel that, you know, if you're filling out an application and you have to check that box that says you've done time, that you think your application will just end up in the recycling bin?
Oh, definitely. Almost every job that I've had has basically I've gotten from people that I know, family members and friends of family. But if I go outside of that, I've never had a call back. Maybe one I had. But otherwise, it's just based on people that I've known.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot for your call. He brings up a lot there. David, first of all, youth, he was 16 and 17-year-olds ending up in adult prison. How common is that now in Wisconsin?
It's fairly common. I don't know the exact numbers, but there's a lot. There used to be many more. We have a lot of people who've been, one of the issues we're trying to work on in Wisdom has to do with old law prisoners, people who were sentenced back in the 80s and 90s before Truth in Sentencing, who are kind of stuck with these really long prison sentences, but a parole system that's kind of broken down. A lot of them were 17, 16, 18 years old. Now they're in their 40s, you know, or 50. And kind of like Josh, I mean, you're not the same person you were when you were 16. You might have done something pretty bad at that point, but people change. And, you know, people deserve a chance to change. People deserve a chance to try and redeem themselves and do better.
And Josh mentioned difficulty getting jobs, and he said something that that made me think. You know, he said the jobs he's gotten are for people he knows. How important, Anthony, is it to have, you know, a social network, the people you can connect to that it might help you find a job or might help you find a place to live, just anything like that? How important is that contact network?
Well, it's very important, and a lot of guys, they come home and they don't have that support group, and that's why a lot of them sometimes don't get jobs. But it's very important because when you're coming home, you know, you really need that. You know, it's housing, job placements, and I spoke with a guy yesterday. He did 16 years in prison, and the first 3 years he was out, he couldn't find a job at all after paying his debt to society. So, and you know, if it wasn't for the people that he started, you know, coming across, he wouldn't have never been employed today.
How do you start building that? I mean, you've been away from the people you know, the people you love for a long time. How do you start rebuilding that when you come back home?
Well, you start by just going out and about, and you know, as you're doing your daily activities, meditation and filling out job applications, you run across people that you've seen and you're like, wow, oh, I've been gone for 5 years. Now you're stepped up to, you know, be a supervisor. You know, you just go from there and just constantly build on. And sometimes it's people that you were incarcerated with that you link up with, you know, when you come home, that actually grow your network.
It's also, if I could, it's one of the things that hopefully through Expo we can start creating better networks of people. There's also some people doing really good work, like Voices Beyond Bars here in Madison, or Project Return, or Table of the Saints in Milwaukee, that really are good networks that try to reach out to be there to catch people when they come out. Because that first time when a person gets out, it's really important to have at least some toehold.
Talking about prison reform nationally and here in Wisconsin with David Liners and Anthony Daly, both with the group Wisdom. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Gary and Rhinelander on the line. Gary, hi.
Hi there. This is a very upsetting subject for me. So, I mean, I've done some time. I've done like a total of 10 years of time in prison, county jails and such. And county jails are definitely worse than prisons. That people want to get to prison so they have more freedom. And this is a very hard subject to me for the reason of that prison was pretty much a playhouse to me. Meaning I can see so many people that they get into prison and all they do is have friends. And they have so much freedom they can do just about anything they want. You know, they have TVs, candy, they can get jobs to get these kind of things. And yet, we wonder why people don't want to stay out of prisons. And you have other areas, you have Arizona that says, you know, they put them out there in the heat. Now, like I said, when it comes to jobs afterwards, yeah, I made mistakes, but I sold myself. I would work for free to show people what I've done.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot, and glad you've made the transition out of there. Gary saying prison too easy. It should be tough. It should be harsh, I guess, so people don't want to go back. Anthony, you want to start on that?
Well, to be sitting in the sun is cruel and unusual. Prison wasn't a walk in the park for me. I had family. I had loved ones that I lost. So some guys may take it as a joke, and those are the guys that you see going back and forth. But there's an issue here that's going on where guys who are going back to prison for simple violations, for having a cell phone or driving without a license, you know, or a nonviolent case, you know, that you know, things like that is not right, you know.
And David, your thoughts on what Gary had to say?
You know, some people may adjust better than others, but for most people, prison is really, really stressful. Matter of fact, I'm often concerned people who adjust too well to prison because it's such an unnatural place to be. So there's not too many people who want to. On the other hand, I think the problem isn't that prison is so pleasant that people want to go back. I think the problem is that it's so difficult once you get back out that in some cases people kind of throw up their hands and say, I can't make it work out here.
Gary, thanks for the call. We'll go to Joy in Kansasville now. Joy, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to tell us about, Joy?
Well, 10 years ago, my son was convicted. I'm sorry, 10 years ago, my son killed himself because of his conviction. He was 22 years old when he was convicted for a small amount of mushrooms that they found on him. And the stigma followed him around, and he could not get a job. He could not. He had a genius IQ. He was very personable. He had never been in trouble before. He didn't even get a speeding ticket, nothing. And it was one dead-end job after another. And the night that he had killed himself, he just said, how can anybody so smart be such a loser? And that's just not something that – there was no rehabilitation. There was nothing. It was a lot of post-sentencing things that were thrown on him, like class after class, and things that were just impossible for him to do because there wasn't enough hours in the day.
Joy, sorry, very sorry for your loss, but thank you for sharing that story. David, that makes me think, before we run out of time, mental health care after someone leaves prison. Does it exist? What is out there? Do we need more?
There's very, very limited mental health care, and yes, we need a lot more. We need a lot more before people go to prison. We need a lot more after they get back. It's one of the big drivers that we have of why we have people in prison. And unfortunately, the prison system is the largest mental health care provider in the country.
And Anthony, before we run out of time, I mean, do you feel it's tough coming back? Obviously, a lot of despair, as we just heard there. Are you feeling some signs of hope in making it in society?
Absolutely. With the things that Wisdom and Expo and Voice Beyond Bars are doing, it's hope. And it gives more hope hearing the president speaking about it. And sorry for your loss, Joy.
Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to David Liners and Anthony Daly of the group Wisdom. It's a grassroots organization of religious congregations working on prison reform issues. Yesterday, President Obama became the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. You can continue this conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.